Welcome back to another episode of Backlash Podcast. This week we are going to talk to traveling guide Brian Klein, Klein Outdoors. The first part of our conversation is literally going to talk about, you know, the passion that drives him and the millions of miles he puts on annually to chase, whether it be waterfowl or any type of hunting or muskies or whatever. He's on the road. He's doing it all. He's chasing down basically his dreams. And, you know, passion drives him. And it's a very cool story. If you're looking to get into, you know, the guide lifestyle, we kind of even touch on that a little bit. But Brad had brought this up to me to make sure we talk about. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is looking for a muskie long-range plan, and they want some public input. So if you go to engage.dnr.state.mn.us, there is a thing here that says, take the questionnaire. Go click on it. It doesn't matter if you live in Minnesota, if you anything to do with Minnesota waters, if you fish it, make sure you go and offer up some input on helping out the DNR in Minnesota develop a long-range muskie plan. So there it is, engage.dnr.state.mn.us. We'll click on it and check it out. Brad, that's our public service announcement. We will also post this on our Facebook page. We can post a link to it. I think it's important for all of us as muskie anglers to offer up our input.
Yeah, absolutely, Jeff. I mean, these types of things are truly important to all of the muskie fisheries throughout whatever state you might be in, but Minnesota is looking for that. Take a couple minutes and fill out the survey and let's get after it. You know, I mean, that's what it's going to take to keep growing our sport that we truly, truly love.
Well, I feel like these types of things are important for us to, you know, work towards, you know, whether it be more stocking or, you know, just better conservation or whatever it takes to try to, you know, preserve muskie fisheries for the future. Because, you know, I don't want to, I don't know how I want to say this. Like, I don't want to negatively talk about forward-facing sonar because I think it's got a lot of positive impacts. But I do also believe that, you know, I had a text conversation recently with somebody, and maybe at some point we'll get him on the podcast to just talk about his thoughts on forward-facing sonar. And they aligned similar to mine. We're not against the use of it whatsoever. We're just about education at this point. You can't put the technology back in the box, essentially. And at this point, we need to make sure that we're doing things ethically because it can have major negative impacts on muskie angling. And Brad, I think we've talked about this a bunch of times on the podcast, but I think it's very important to say that these things, we need to all work together for the better of the future, because if these technologies are used poorly, I guess is a way to say it, it can have, you know, lasting impacts because of how long it takes for, you know, muskies to develop and grow.
Yeah, you're not wrong, Jeff. You know, I've said it many times on the podcast, it comes with true responsibility. And at the end of the day, at my age, maybe not yours, Jeff, you're a little younger, but, you know, at my age, I have to be concerned about our fisheries. And if we want to have a future for our youth and so on and so forth, it definitely is something that we have to be concerned about. And so I the best thing I can say is that I want to see the muskie platform to continue to grow. I mean, this is my livelihood. So it's very, very important to me. And I know it is as well as to you. And I would love to see our youth be able to experience some of the things that I've been able to experience in the last 30 years or so.
Yeah, totally agree with you. Like, that's what it's all about, which is, I mean, that's been, you know, one of our missions for a long time. And so, again, this rant sort of let, you know, it comes off the survey, but it's important for all of us to offer our inputs so that we could, you know, work together to try to make sure that muskie fishing is a viable sport for many, many years to come. And, like, again, I'm sort of pointing the finger at forward facing sonar, but I'm not against the technology whatsoever. I'm just saying the same thing Brad just said. It comes with great responsibility. We need to make sure that we're being as ethical as we can be when we're using it, especially when it comes to, you know, musky angling. I think with other fish, you'll see, you know, bag limit issue or things come up. I wouldn't say issues. There are going to be questions on that in the future because of, you know, over harvest potential and things like that. So, you know, we all need to, you know, just bind together as musky anglers to work towards a common goal, and that's to have, you know, high functioning musky populations everywhere muskies swim. With that being said, we'll get off our little rant there, and we'll get on with this week's episode shortly. But obviously, we need to, you know, infomercial you one time before we go. If you're looking for gear for your next musky fishing adventures, make sure you check out TeamRhinoOutdoors.com. And rods were the theme of the week. We've added a handful of rods, and we'll add a handful of more. So if you're looking for like Okuma, Elk River, trolling rods from Musky Innovations, one-piece rods from Musky Innovations, they're all available on our website. And I do a few other Elk Rivers that will likely not get on the website before you hear this podcast, but those are things to check out this week. And Joe Booker Outdoors, if you want, we have two new colors available in a few different style baits from Joe Booker. So go check those out, TeamRhinoOutdoors.com. And we can't forget about our friends over there at Musky Mayhem Tackle. So Brad, why don't you take it away?
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. You know, Musky Mayhem Tackle, one of the originals, I guess the OG, if you will, and Flashaboo big-bladed inline spinners. So, I mean, if you want to check us out, it's at muskymayhemtackle.com. You can order your customs, basically build out anything you really want to at that point, and check us out on the website. We'd love to have you as a customer. And otherwise, you can go right to Team Rhino Outdoors, where you can find a bunch of different custom colors as well.
And one last thing I did want to say is I have had people reach out to me recently, and they say, hey, when are you going to, you know, we posted about an episode of our Team Rhino Outdoors Musky Fishing Podcast. I think it was last week. And people are like, hey, I can't find it. And they said the newest one is episode 264. Well, that's because it's under the Backlash Podcast. That's what you're looking at. Team Rhino Outdoors Musky Fishing Podcast is a separate solo podcast. I fired Brad. I got tired of dealing with him. He's hard to deal with. So if you believe any of that, it's total BS. But anyways, I have a solo podcast. It's Team Rhino Outdoors Musky Fishing Podcast. Go check it out. Subscribe to it on all the platforms that you would listen to this one. It's got nothing to do. We're not breaking up. In fact, I had this podcast for, I don't know, Brad, what is it, 2020? I've had it for a long time.
Yeah, it's been a while.
It's just been mostly stagnant, but I want to fire it up. I recently, I don't know, I've gotten a renewed passion for creating some content, so I want to put that out. And I just talked to a bunch of different industry professionals, and we'll do a little bit of stuff with guides, and it's a very short podcast. I think the one I released today, this is April 2nd, was, I don't know, 17 minutes long. I think last week's episode might have been 25. In fact, I had Brad on recently talking about grenades. His was probably one of the longest ones at like 35, you know, minutes long. So short form content, go check it out. Team Rhino Outdoors Musky Fishing Podcast.
Probably because I rambled, Jeff. You never know.
Rambled or mumbled?
Maybe both.
No, I think actually it was pretty clear, concise. I don't think there was very much rambling or mumbling. It was, if people are, you know, we'll plug that podcast. If people go back to, I think it was roughly 4 or 5 weeks ago. I've been really consistent with that podcast. But if they go back to a few weeks ago and they're looking to, they want to know the ins and outs of a grenade and how to fish it, it will absolutely help them fish the grenade better this season. I guarantee it. There's no way it'll make them a worse grenade angler.
That's good news.
Yep. But enough about that. If you want, check that podcast out, and you stay tuned for our conversation right here with Brian Klein, Klein Outdoors. All right. Our guest this week is Brian Klein with Klein Outdoors. And Brian, thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule to talk, you know, all things outdoors with you. It's not just fishing, but in this case, we're going to try to bring this conversation to fishing. But I mean, as you're going to learn in this conversation we're having tonight, that fishing isn't just all you do. You're a general outdoorsman. I mean, that's what you live and breathe and do all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate you guys having me on. I absolutely love the fishing aspect as well, but yeah, I do a wide variety of outdoor things. It's kind of what drives my passion. I kind of like that variety. I don't do well at doing one thing for a long time. I like to do a lot of different things.
Well, as they're also going to find out, you also don't like to do the one thing in one place either, because you're, it sounds like you're in Wisconsin right now, but you weren't on a handful of different occasions where we tried to get in touch with you this spring.
Right. Yeah, I just got back to Wisconsin now. I just finished up a guide run down in Arkansas. We run a snow goose guide service down there. And when that wound up, I stay down there and do some hog removal for my farmers down there. So I've kind of been down in Arkansas since kind of the end of January and just got back up here for Easter.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, it's a really cool story. You know, Brian, why don't you talk a little bit about your guide service, a little bit about what you do? We're going to kind of center this conversation mostly about that, but let's just give people an introduction in a brief way to it, and then we'll start firing some questions at you. And if people want to get in touch with you for, you know, your guide services, why don't you let people know where they can get in touch with you there?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook, Brian J. Klein or Klein Outdoors, either way. My website is www.kleinoutdoors.net. You can find all my information there. I kind of do a variety of things which we've touched on a little bit, but the main focus of my summer stuff is muskies. I start my season at the end of May, and that's in Green Bay on the tributaries and the lower bay. I'm muskie fishing basically from about the end of May. I usually end my guide season right around October 15th on Green Bay. Most of my summer stuff, I bounce around quite a bit. I kind of like to offer different kinds of trips based on what my customers are looking for. Not everybody wants to go out and face the zoo that can be Green Bay and fight big water for the chance at a giant fish. A lot of my customers are looking for, you know, the experience. And so I do stuff in northern Wisconsin. I do a lot of inland stuff. I grew up in southeast Wisconsin, you know, fishing Pewaukee, Okaechee, that kind of stuff. And so I still do a couple weeks a year down there as well. And that kind of keeps the way of moving around and fishing different stuff. It keeps me in the game. I do tend to get, I don't know, bored's the right word, but I don't like to do the same thing every day. And so I've kind of fashioned my guide service around kind of being in the best position at the best time for whatever that is I'm doing. The summer months are musky stuff. Like I say, I kind of do inland stuff. I do some river stuff. And we also do, of course, the Green Bay, Great Lakes stuff. In the fall, we're guiding duck hunts. We've got big water, Great Lakes stuff, layout boat stuff for old squaws and for divers on Green Bay. I also run quite a few duck hunts, dry land duck hunts in South Dakota. So I move around quite a bit. And when somebody calls to book with me, I like to talk to them and kind of get a feel for what they're looking to get out of that trip, whether it's a muskie trip or a hunting trip. Like I say, not everybody's necessarily looking for the same goals. Some people just want to catch a muskie. Others want to specifically learn how to troll Green Bay better, or, you know, troll big water stuff, how to break that water down. Everybody's just got different goals. And what I like to do is just talk to them about that and try to tailor the trip or fit them into the schedule, I guess, where it makes the most sense to accomplish those goals. And it keeps me interested and it keeps me fired up. You know, I've got a lot of passion for a lot of things in the outdoors, and I've learned that over the years, that's what I like to do, is to do a lot of different things well. And so I've made my living kind of doing that and bouncing around the country and fishing different waters and hunting different waterfowl. And I mean, I do a little bit of everything. I do some big game stuff. I do a lot of waterfowl. I do a lot of upland bird stuff. I've got English setters. I've got labs. So I kind of pride myself on kind of offering up all those different experiences.
Well, it's super interesting to me, Brian, that you know, we share some of the same passions, muskies as well as the waterfowl. And I've done a lot of big game hunting myself. How do you manage that whole circle? I mean, you're telling me, you know, you're talking to your clients and you're actually putting together what they deserve or what their expectations are. And I've handled my own guiding that way as well, where we get in the boat, the first thing I do is ask them, why did you book me? And it sounds like you're doing that exact same thing. How do you manage how and what you're going to do with them? And then again, how do you manage your timing on what you're actually trying to accomplish?
Yeah, I mean, that, as you know, can certainly be a difficult thing, especially when you're looking at, when you're dealing with wild animals, you know, certainly migratory birds and certainly muskies also, seasonal movements and seasonal migrations, you know, chasing bait. It's definitely something that comes with experience. And over the years, you kind of learn, hey, this usually kind of peters out about this time of year, and I'm usually kind of over it and ready to do something different. So a lot of that timing is just based on experience. And I've always, you know, I've ran a guide service since 2000. I started it when I was in college, and I ran it part-time for many, many years while I worked in the electrical industry. And I just, over time, I just realized more and more that my happy place was not in that office, that I was happiest out in the field or in the woods or on the water. And so I've always been kind of a traveler. I got that from my dad when I was young. You know, every weekend we would jump in the truck and drive somewhere to go, you know, bird hunting or go fishing somewhere else. And so at a very early age, driving to go to destinations was never a chore for me. It was always an excitement thing. And that was part of what I enjoyed about all those different experiences. I mean, you know, I've caught a ton of muskies in my life, and so many of them are special in so many different ways, just for going to a new destination and figuring out a new body of water or a new technique or meeting somebody halfway across the world and fishing with them and forming a friendship over that. And it's not always about the biggest fish. I mean, I can't tell you how many 35-inch muskies that I've caught that may not mean anything otherwise, not for the size of the fish, but it was the experience. You know, it was a canoe trip or a kayak trip, or the first time I fished a new body of water. And, you know, it doesn't always happen right away. And when you finally put a little piece of that puzzle together, it makes that, you know, so much more meaningful. But as far as the scheduling goes, you know, I'm an outdoorsman first and foremost, and I enjoy guiding and I enjoy taking people and showing them that lifestyle. But also I'm a little bit selfish in that I enjoy doing my own trips and doing my own things as well. So kind of when I sit down at the beginning of the year to set my guiding schedule, I've already blocked off periods of time where I'm just going to go, and I may not even know exactly what I'm going to do, but I know that I leave myself a week here or a week there at different times of the year to explore new places and just go on new trips. And that's not always necessarily guiding. So once I kind of set my fun schedule, so to speak, I've got certain date ranges that I know historically. You know, I love the northern Wisconsin open water bite on those northern Wisconsin inland lakes. I love that summer open water stuff. So I spend a couple weeks in northeast Wisconsin doing that. You know, I'm always there for the Great Lakes opener. I absolutely love Green Bay with all its pressure and everything else. It's one of my favorite places in the world to fish. I'll always be there for the opener, and I'll always do a guide run for that. You know, August, September, October, it's pretty difficult for me to want to be anywhere else other than Green Bay. And that's, so, you know, those months I'm on the water every day, basically all day. I'm only a couple hours a day that I'm not on the water that time of year, because quite honestly, that's overall a short season in the grand scheme of things. So, you know, I make sure that I'm there when I think that that's going to be the best. And then later on in the fall, you know, Green Bay isn't my favorite place to be in November. You know, there's other Cisco waters that I'd rather be on. So, you know, after that Green Bay run, what I kind of consider the peak time, kind of that mid-October, It's not that I won't go back there, I won't fish it still, but I kind of back away and I don't do that on a daily basis. That's when I kind of branch out. I like to do some of my Minnesota stuff, some of the Canadian stuff. And so I just kind of schedule that based on what I think is the best place to be at that given time. And I do the same with the waterfowl. And when you're talking migrating birds, you know, sometimes you hit it right on the head and it's a normal year and the birds kind of show up where you expect them to, when you expect them to. But it doesn't always go that way. You know, this spring snow goose was a prime example. A lot of the birds left Arkansas a lot faster than we've ever seen them do, at least southern Arkansas. So there's always kind of that adjustment. You do the best that you can to schedule your customers to be able to put them in the best position that you can. And the rest is kind of up to Mother Nature, and you got to be a little bit flexible. Sometimes we got to drive a little further to get to where the birds are, or sometimes the water isn't quite right temperature-wise. The fish aren't where I expect them to be, and we've got to make some adjustments and figure out a new pattern. But a lot of that is just flexibility and just leaning on that prior experience to put yourself in the best position you can.
Yeah, you know, I got a question for you. How many miles do you think you put on in a year? Like just driving around?
It's usually between 100 and 120,000. I've got two vehicles that I primarily use. I've got a truck and a Subaru. If I don't need to haul a trailer, I can get by with the Subaru. If I need a trailer, I'm hauling the F-250. It's, you know, this last year, about 110,000. It's usually right in that 100 to 120 range.
Unbelievable. So what's the gas bill for the year? $10,000?
I don't even want to know. Whatever it is, and it's just built into the cost. I don't even want to know what my total gas bill was last year.
I got another question for you then. It kind of is along those same lines. Like, how many different states do you hold a fishing license in?
You know, it varies from year to year. Typically, between hunting and fishing licenses, it's typically between 15 and 20 states a year. And certainly not all of that is guiding, and certainly it does vary from year to year. Some of that is based on draws, you know, on some of my limited draw hunts and stuff like that. But there's kind of a traditional 10 states or so that I'm in every year, and the rest of it is kind of rotational. I just kind of, a lot of times I try to pick a new destination that I've never been to just go check it out. And a lot of times that's a summer trip. I've done a bunch of trips out west, doing like the Utah Tiger stuff, the Washington Tiger stuff. And so there's just a lot of times I'll just kind of pick somewhere that I've never been and go, hey, I'm going to go check that out. And I enjoy that. I enjoy that challenge of just going somewhere I've never been and figuring it all out.
So that'd be one other question I have then is like, so obviously you're bouncing around from place to place. Do you spend a lot of time sleeping in your vehicle? Are you doing some camping trips? Do you have lodging in all these different places that you are? What does that look like?
It's a little bit of everything. So Green Bay, I've got a trailer that I rent out, a pole barn. I've got a travel trailer in there. And so I'm living the trailer life for about 3 months a year. We've got a family cabin over in Southwest Wisconsin. I'll base out of there for quite a bit of the turkey season. And I run some inland stream brown trips out of there. I do a lot of my mushroom foraging stuff out of there. I do a lot of morel mushroom stuff in the spring. So I'm there for a couple months a year. We do have a lodge that we run out of in South Dakota that I'll stay at when I'm out there. The Arkansas thing, we run Snow Addictions Guide Service. So we have 5 lodges down there that we rent out for the snow goose season. So we kind of bounce around between those depending upon where we're located and what we have for clients coming in. But there's certainly plenty of nights slept in the truck. The Subaru seat leans back. The truck seat leans back. I've been known to crawl in the back of the truck, across the back seat of the truck. I definitely do some camping, definitely live out of some motels. It really depends on where I'm at and what the weather's doing and if I've got my dogs with me or not. I've got 3 dogs that are on the road with me most of the time. You know, there's some summer trips that it's just not conducive to having them with me if I'm going to be on the water 20 hours a day and it's going to be 90 degrees and I have nowhere to keep them. So I've got a buddy that'll watch them for me if I'm gone. But for the most part, it's me and the dogs traveling around.
Well, Brian, you're alluding to a bunch of different things, right? at the end of the day, how did you arrive at your destination? Meaning, how did you get to where you are right now? I think that's super intriguing. And, you know, so many people ask us all the time, you know, we should talk about how you become a guide or how you do this or how you do that. You are doing something way bigger and more incredible than most musky guides that are out there. So can you kind of share to the listener how you arrived where you are today?
Yeah, I mean, I've always had the passion for it. And I think that's one of the biggest things. And I mean, I see a lot of, you know, obviously in this industry, I know a ton of guides. I know a ton of waterfall guides. I know a ton of musky guides. And a lot of times I see them starting to get burnt out. And I see their attitude shift over the years. And it's a grueling job. You know, everybody thinks, oh, it's so great. You know, you get paid to go fishing every day. And we all know that that's not the end of it. I mean, you know, it's long hours. You're at the mercy of your equipment. I mean, I can't tell you how many times that you just are getting ahead and something breaks down and you're right back to where you started. And, you know, we rely on our equipment. If your truck breaks down, it's very tough to run a guide trip. And so it's a difficult career. I've been doing it for a long time. Like I said, I had started in 2000 part-time as a trout fishing guide. I was in college bouncing at a bar and a guy started talking to me. I had a fishing shirt on and he's talking to me about brown trout. And he's, you know, telling me how he hires this guide and his dream to catch a 20-inch brown trout. And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, I caught a 20 and a quarter today in a stream around here. And he, you know, his jaw drops. And this was, you know, back in the day of digital camera. Well, I had my digital camera. So, you know, I scroll through and show him some pictures. And he goes, man, that's a great brown. You know, have you ever considered guiding? Kind of, nah, you know, I was fun fishing. Well, you know, I'm paying $400 a day. Well, yeah, maybe I can become a guide. I'm interested. And, you know, went and got my guide license and started guiding some brown trout trips. And I enjoyed that. You know, I enjoyed showing people my passion and the places that I know and where to fish and the joy of somebody, you know, accomplishing their goal and catching the fish that they're after has always been rewarding to me. And so I've always part-time guided. I worked as an electrical contractor for years. I'm in the family business. My dad was an electrician and bought an electrical contracting company when I was 15. And so I had worked there and we built that company up and I did enjoy that work. But at the end of the day, it was still all about getting outside and going hunting and going fishing. And so I had always still ran a part-time guide service. You know, I'd do evening musky trips. I'd take a couple weeks off in the spring to go guide snow goose hunts. And as technology advanced, you know, that was easier to do with the smartphones and tablets. You know, I could be out of the office and still handle a lot of those things. And so I found myself, you know, enjoying that guiding more and more and more. And at one point, I had just decided that that's really the direction I wanted to go. And, you know, becoming a full-time guide, it's a big step. And it's certainly, you know, there was a lot more to it. I mean, you know, I went from having, you know, health insurance and a steady income paycheck to, you know, no insurance and having to do everything on my own as far as expense-wise. And, you know, you get sick. There's no sick days in guiding. You just don't get paid. You don't make any money. You know, your equipment breaks down and you're stranded in another city with no way to get back and you've got a guide trip tomorrow. Doesn't matter. You don't make money. And that's a big adjustment. And it takes a lot of discipline to stay busy, to be able to schedule all those guide trips and really run that grind year round. I mean, so many guys, you know, a lot of musky guides, they've got to have something else in the off season. It's short of a season. Whether that's a bait builder or, you know, whether it's running walleye trips or, you know, some guys are just doing a part-time job, totally unrelated. And to be a full-time year-round guide, it definitely takes, It takes a lot of dedication. It takes a lot of hard work, and you've got to be willing to put up with some of those hardships to make it happen. It's not always easy, especially when you're putting on all those miles on your equipment and all that on your gear. You know, there's people ask me what I do in the off season. I don't have an off season, and that's by choice. I mean, that's me. I'm a goer. I don't do well sitting around, but there is no off season for me. I mean, I roll from one thing to the next, and yeah, there may be a week or two or three off where I get to just kind of work on equipment and get prepared for the next run. But there really isn't an off season for me. It's a year round deal.
So I got to ask, what do your parents think of this lifestyle?
Well, you know, they've always known how I am. You know, they and I, like I say, I learned from my dad to, you know, to travel, to hunt and fish, and my family, we took a family vacation every year. You know, we drive somewhere, you know, drive to Maine, drive to Montana. So I was never any stranger to driving or the long road trips, and we always incorporated some hunting and fishing in those kinds of trips. And my parents always knew that, you know, I belonged out there in the wilderness. I mean, I think they both probably looked at it like, this probably isn't the wisest financial decision. And, you know, I'm certainly struggling financially more than I ever did when I had a full-time, what I'm going to call a real job, but I wouldn't trade it. You know, I've never been happier. It's what makes me happy. You know, when they see my schedule, and you know, that's just kind of the joke is, hey, where are you today? I'm in Montana. Oh, when are you coming back? You know, I don't know. So, but they've always supported me in everything I do. And I think that they knew that this was coming at some point. I mean, you know, when I was in like middle school, you know, you had to make a business card of what you did. I made Klein's Outdoor Adventures Guide Service. I mean, I knew that was what I wanted to do, but it's just not necessarily an easy career path.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I mean, I'm just thinking to myself, like people think to me, you know, they say to me and I see my shows, like, I don't know how you do everything you do, but I'm staying in one state. All right. So like I do some wiring, you know, and that's here in the state. And then, you know, like everything I do for the most part is within one state. And I just can't imagine the amount of effort it takes just being that much, you know, that many hours on the road and that much dedication, that much time. It's, you know, it honestly is pretty incredible. And I just think to myself, there are very few people that would probably not only want to do what you do, but be able to do what you do. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. It's definitely, there's, you know, something that a lot of people don't think about is, you know, you go on the road, you know, I haven't been back to my home or my base, you know, since mid-January. So it's like, I'm getting ready to go on a trip and I've got to, okay, when am I going to be home next? What do I need to have with me for the next 2.5 months or 3 months or whatever? You know, oh, I'm going south to guide snow goose hunts, but you know what? I'm probably not going to be back here before turkey season. I better throw my vest in. I better throw a couple decoys in. And I mean, my clothing, I mean, in the past month, I've seen below zero and I've seen 100 degrees. So, you know, I've got every piece of clothing to cover that range. You never know what you're going to run into when you're talking those kinds of distances to north to south and the different climates that I'm in. You don't really ever know what you're going to run across. It could be 80 tomorrow and it could be 10 below zero the next day.
I just think about trying to pack my kids for a weekend up north. They have a hard time with that. I can only imagine if they were doing this job, it'd be funny.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. People look at my truck and go, oh, my God, do you live in this thing? Absolutely, I do. I mean, that is my home office. I'm in my truck more than I'm in anything else.
Well, it kind of goes back to, I've guided out west. I guided in Montana. I guided in Wyoming back in my early days. And it's something that I've always said as a guide, you know, you hope for the best, prepare for the worst. And I think that's your lifestyle at this point, Brian.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So Brian, I mean, you grew up with the passion, obviously, and you've talked about how your family traveled and the things that you were going out to do, but how did you build these relationships so that you could, you know, you were empowered to be able to go do these different types of guide trips or outfitting trips? How did you build these relationships throughout the country in order to actually go out and do what you're living today?
You know, there's a lot of different aspects to that. You know, certainly guiding is, you definitely need to surround yourself with the right people, and you need to have the right people in the right places to be able to facilitate all of that travel and everything like that. And one of the things that has helped me do that over the years is kind of like a swap, a hunt, swap an experience type of thing. And, you know, a lot of these people along the way, I've met them through social media. I've met them through travel. I've met them through conservation organizations. You know, we do a lot of Ducks Unlimited work. And I've met a lot of great people along the way there, the Rough Grouse Society. And so, you know, as you're traveling and starting a guide service and building a guide service, you know, I've had a lot of help along the way from friends of mine as well, as far as, you know, helping me check out new areas and saying, hey, this is an area that these birds stage up in, you know, we can do something here. And so the destination has changed over the years, depending on a lot of different factors. But a lot of those friendships and partnerships that I formed many years ago, you know, those people are still with me, still in my corner. And whether they're guiding for me or guiding with me, or we're guiding together, there's a lot of collaboration that comes along with that. And a lot of that just comes from, you know, from forging those relationships and friendships and just being straightforward with people. You know, there's a lot of things can go awry in the guiding world as far as, you know, when money's exchanged. You know, people are making money. People feel like they should get a share of that money. The big thing is that one of the things that I've always just done is I'm just always honest with everybody that I'm working with. And we've always been able to make those relationships work. And usually it's a beneficial to both parties. Hey, I need to come hunt your farm. I need to do some guiding on there. What's that worth to you? Here's my thought. I'm going to pay you this. And we're going to hunt this. We're going to hunt your farm for the next 8 days with this many hunters. And as long as you're up front with most of those people, there's benefit to be made for both parties. And same with, you know, the guys that guide with me and for me, you know, it's a mutual respect thing. A lot of those guys, they respect me. They know that I would never ask them to do something that I wouldn't do, and vice versa. I respect them and I trust them. If they tell me, hey, you need to come fish this lake, this bite is fire, yet you're going to love it, I'm going to go if I trust them. And same with waterfowling. Hey, the birds are here. You need to get here. This is where the right birds are. And those people that I rely on for that information, it's a two-way street. They can call me and I'm going to tell them the same thing. And it's all about honesty and helping each other out. And that's really important in this industry. It's like anything. You build these relationships on your character and you treat people the way you want to be treated. And usually in the end, it works out.
Yeah, I won't argue with that. I mean, it can be as simple as at a different level, networking with a group of guys about fishing, right?
Absolutely.
When the honesty is broke, that's where things go awry. So, I mean, honesty is a big factor in that, and you hit on that. And I think that's really important. So if you guys are going to network together, all you can do is be honest, you know, and it might hurt at times, but honesty always saves everything.
Absolutely. A man is only as good as his word. And once you break that trust, you know, that there's no repairing it.
You're absolutely right. I've seen it happen too many times in this industry, you know, whether it be two guides or five guides, it doesn't matter. I mean, as soon as you know somebody's maybe lying to you, it always falls apart. So, I mean, a network can be such a major, major key in success in this whole sport. And that network doesn't have to be between guides. It could be just a group of fishermen that work together as well. So those networks are so key. And I think it's amazing. And I think it says a lot about who you are, Brian, that, you know, you have built this network over a period of years. Not only in fishing, but through the hunting world as well. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's it's pretty interesting when you look at, you know, a lot of the outdoorsmen, you know, a lot of the guys that are those diehard musky guys, you know, there's a lot of common background. A lot of them are either, you know, they're also diehard hunters. And just a lot of musky guys are just outdoorsmen. And that's, you know, people have asked me before, so wait a minute, you guide for muskies and snow geese, two of the most miserable things and unpredictable things in the world? Absolutely, because that's what drives me. That's what's exciting to me. And there's a lot of similarities in outdoorsmen. What do you see? A lot of us have those similar hobbies.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I think off recording last week's episode, we were talking and discussing some of the different things that happen outside of maybe the recording, if you will. But we were talking to Matt Gunkel from Lungeon Lures, and we were talking about Chad Kane and his involvement in the muskie guiding side of things, and kind of where he kind of disappeared or walked away. And, you know, the amazing part to the muskie world, and I think you hit it on the head here just a second ago with saying that we're kind of all in or all out, if that makes any sense at all. And I think that's part of our personalities when it comes to whether it be hunting or it be muskie fishing or whatever it is. The outdoors world, generally speaking, we tend to be all in or all out. And that's kind of how this works. And I think that kind of resonates in what you're talking about right now as well.
Yeah, I mean, if I feel like I can't give it everything I've got and I can't do the best that I can, I don't want to do it at all. And so that a lot of that goes back to some of those traveling decisions that I make, as far as I want to be where I'm setting my guys up for the best success at that time, whether that's based on bait or weed growth or water temps or seasonal migration or whatever that is. I want to be in the best position that I can be at that time. And if that's not right, then I don't want to be there then.
Makes perfect sense. And I know that scheduling can't always be perfectly easy, right? You know, we've just come off of a crazy, crazy winter here in the Midwest. So if you think about it, you know, are we advanced? Are we not? It's weird, though, how Mother Nature always seems to come back to ground zero, right? We always regulate and even back out at some point. But all in all, I mean, you're still concerned about those things and you're still trying to figure that out. So let's switch gears and let's just talk more about muskies at this point. So you're doing your best. You're trying to plan exactly where you should be, when you should be there, and portraying that guide trip to your clientele. Managing all of that can be quite bizarre, but it sounds like you're pretty loose on your feet. So, I mean, if you see, hey, Green Bay isn't the answer, are you going to sway some of your clients to move, you know, 3 days, 2 weeks before, whatever it might be? Is that how you kind of react to that?
Yeah, I mean, pretty typically on the Bay, you know, if something's not going to be right, it's overall, it's going to be a short-term deal. But I've absolutely done that before where, you know, I see a cold front come in, we get a big blow out of the southwest, pushes all our warm water out. That water temperature drops 12 degrees overnight. And I'm looking at the weather saying it's not going to repair itself in the next 3 to 4 days. You know, I don't want to be out there. I don't want to take somebody's money. And it's not just about catching, but if I know that the chances of us finding one of those really good fish in those conditions are not ideal, and a lot of that also comes back to the weather. You know, Green Bay can be miserable nasty. If I'm looking at the weather and I've got a family trip coming up and it's 3 straight days of a 25 mile an hour northeast wind, they're not going to enjoy that. Neither am I. So, you know, some in that scenario, I'll reach out to them and I'll just be honest with them. Hey, here's where we're at. Here's what the forecast is showing. Here are my thoughts. I think we're better off driving a little bit north and fishing some inland stuff where we can get out of that wind and you're going to enjoy it better and we're still going to catch some fish. So I absolutely will change on the fly. I hate to give up on big water like Green Bay. We've had some great days, of course, in some nasty conditions. But part of that, too, is reading the customer. I've got most of my customer base is repeat. I don't have a lot of turnover. most of my same people take their same dates every year. And I'm able to make some changes and add some new people in here and there. But for the most part, it's repeats. And, you know, I've got some customers that have a bad back. You know, he can't be in really rough water. Well, if he's coming to Green Bay for 2 days and it's a 30-mile-an-hour wind, guess what? That water is going to be rough. And so I'll look at that and say, hey, what do you think? I'm telling you that it's going to be rough every day. And we can go and do that. We can fight that. Or we can go to a 300-acre inland lake and we can get out of that wind. And you're probably going to have a better trip because of it. And as long as I feel like I'm honest with them and I present them with the options and the knowledge that I have, you know, obviously I can't predict the weather any more than anybody else can. But I can look at that and say, hey, it looks like it's going to be pretty crummy for the next 3 days. You know, we'll make that adjustment. And sometimes that costs me some money, some profit. You know, if I've got to turn around and drive somewhere else and get a motel instead of staying in my base camp, so be it. Part of that is me trying to give my customers the best experience that I can.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I think, you know, all in all, if you go with a really good muskie guide, they all think the same way, right? We always want to give the best potential to our clients. And that might mean 12 hours, 16 hours, or whatever it might mean. It might mean that you drive 2 hours to get to the water that you believe is the better answer. So, no, I love that, Brian. I think it definitely goes to show. I mean, you just said it. You hit it on the head. You have tons and tons of return clientele. That means you're doing something right. So, to that, I praise you because I think that means a lot and it stands out.
You know, Brian, I guess the one thing I can ask you is, of all the places you've chased muskies, which one's your favorite?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. You know, my absolute favorite would be the St. Lawrence River.
And is it just because of the allure of a giant, giant fish?
Giant fish. There's just such a variety of stuff to fish. I was never much of a current fisherman before going out there. And so there was a big learning curve there. So to me, when there's a bigger learning curve, there's more reward. You know, when you finally start to put some of those pieces of that puzzle together, that's really rewarding for me. And that's just kind of different water than anything I had ever really fished before. And so I really just have enjoyed the challenge of that. And absolutely, there's some great fish there. You know, the Great Lakes are where I spend most of my time in general. I'm a big water fisherman. I'm a Great Lakes fisherman. I certainly do the inland stuff, and I certainly enjoy the exact opposite of that in fishing skinny water as a changeup. But day in and day out, you know, I'm a Great Lakes angler, and that's my favorite stuff. The big water, the bigger, the nastier, the better for me.
All right. Well, conversely, let me ask you this. Is there any place you've musky fished and you're like, you know, there was a lot of hype around that or whatever, and I just don't feel like I really need to go back there. That wasn't as cool of an adventure as I thought it would be.
Well, not necessarily the place, but I used to fish the PMTT, and I hated going to Cave Run in the early spring when we would go down there. I just never had a great trip, spent hours and hours, certainly caught some fish, but just I never, like, it just seemed like the patterns were changing constant, and it just always felt like this is a dumb time to be here. And I always just felt like if I never go back there in April again, I'm totally fine with that.
Yeah.
But I do like the water. So I would like to go back, but every time I've gone there, it was PMTT time, and it's always the same time. And I never cared for it.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. And that's one thing where when I fished the PMTT, and there was times that I think I've said it on this podcast or different podcast. I distinctly remember traveling to Leech Lake, and the bite there hadn't been that great, but yet the Green Bay bite had been really great. And knowing that I was in for a long ride and potentially tough fishing at that, you know, tournament, whereas I could have just went, you know, 45 minutes north to Green Bay and, you know, had the potential to put a lot of fish in the net. And so that to me was, it's not exactly what you're saying, but it's similar. You know, you're being told where and when to go fishing, and that's not always what you want to do.
Right. And but conversely, part of what I liked about that also was it did take me out of my comfort zone, and it forced me to go check out new water at certain times that there's places that I probably would have never gone to had it not been for the PMTT. So I do like that as well. It forced me to kind of check some of those places out, but a lot of those experiences were, I would come back here, but not at this time of year. And also, man, I don't love the tournaments. Like my strength is just doing my own thing and just being out there and being out there as long as it takes, or fishing through the night, or fishing every photo period till I figure something out. And so I never really enjoyed the tournament fishing that much. I just don't. Like, I always just feel like I'm being forced to fish this little window when that's not my game. I mean, I have no problem spending 20 hours a day on the water. That's what I enjoy. So to fish a partial day, to come off when I'm looking at it going, we got prime time coming up, whether it's a moon or a photo period or a weather change. So I learned a while ago that I much prefer guiding and fun fishing versus tournament fishing. It's not my favorite.
That's a perfect answer. I mean, I can't ask for, it's 100% honest. And it makes sense, right? I've heard that same complaint from other anglers. Like, yeah, we're forced to fish basically, essentially some of the worst times that you would go fishing. You know, if most anglers aren't looking to go fishing from 7 o'clock till 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock or whatever it ends up being. You know,
I prefer to be taking my nap at that time and fishing the rest of the day. So that was a difficult adjustment for me for sure.
Well, should we switch over to just, you know, we'll spend the rest of this conversation just talking about, you know, tips or tactics or whatever, you know, things that you've noticed on the water, because I think we've probably covered, you know, the guide lifestyle from what I can tell. What do you guys think?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So, Brian, I think it's probably safe to say that you're a troller at heart. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. It's my favorite. You know, we certainly do everything, jigging, live bait, casting, but my favorite is trolling, absolutely.
And what is it about it, I guess? Because it's weird. Like, I had a period of my musky career where I loved to troll. It was awesome. I honestly never thought I would want to go back casting. Then somewhere along the line, I made the change back where I wanted to cast, and that's all I want to do right now. I don't want to troll, even though I feel like I'm a fairly proficient troller. Like, and I'm not blaming you. I'm not against trolling whatsoever. In fact, I wish I could get back into it again, because it's a fantastic way to cover water. I'm just curious, like, what is it about trolling that you like so much?
You know, I like, especially in guiding, I like the aspect of trolling, because for me, it's all about just tricking that fish to eating. The fight of the fish for the client, that's not the adrenaline for me. It's when I get that fish to eat. So, you know, to me, that rip, just there's nothing else like it for me for that adrenaline rush. It gets me going. I absolutely love it. And I feel like I can control so much more of it from a technical standpoint. I can control that depth. I can play around with establishing patterns so much faster than I can casting, as far as running baits at different depths, running different style baits all at that same time. And so, you know, growing up in Wisconsin, as you know, I mean, the three line deal, not everybody has that opportunity. And so for me, I've always utilized that, and it helps me pinpoint patterns so much faster than it ever has for me casting. And I certainly enjoy casting, and I certainly do enjoy that mixing it up, and I love jigging, and I don't do as much sucker fishing as I used to. I used to do quite a bit in the fall, but quite honestly, now it's just more of a time thing. At that point, I'm transitioning into bird hunting quite a bit, and if I'm going to be doing fall fishing, I'm going to be doing some casting, and I'm going to be doing some night trolling. So I just don't get to do as much of the live bait stuff anymore, but I really do enjoy all of it. And even when I'm on a really good troll bite, I'm still looking at those casting opportunities and still doing some casting and checking of certain spots that I like to cast just to try to stay ahead of that bite. But I've learned so much about patterns and fish behavior from trolling, which I think a lot of people don't necessarily see that. Like, well, how can you learn more than you can casting? And I'm not saying that it's more. It's just I've learned so much on putting together patterns that I don't think that I necessarily would have found out if I was just casting. I just wouldn't have necessarily done some of that stuff or run at that depth or that style bait. And so the thing that I love about trolling is there's so many different facets to it. I mean, literally any bait in the world can be trolled, and it's not just about driving the boat around and finding one. I mean, anybody that knows anything about actually trolling, there are so many variables to it that it never gets boring to me. It just doesn't. I'm always changing stuff. I'm always trying to figure something else out. There's no doubt about it. I absolutely love it when a big fish just comes and eats at my feet. I love it too. I love it just as much as anybody. But I also get just as excited when that outside board dumps at 4 miles an hour. It's just that to me, I just enjoy it so much. It's difficult for me to not bounce around and do a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I totally get it. And for anglers that are listening, in my opinion, if you don't know how to proficiently cast, troll, and jig, I feel like you're missing out on opportunities to catch fish when, like, there are certain times where, I mean, I'm sure you'll admit it, the trolling bite is better than the casting bite. I mean, Green Bay, thinking that if it's mid-September, you're probably going to do a lot better trolling than you are casting. But, I mean, I haven't been on to Green Bay in a while, so maybe I'm wrong, but that's the way it always had been.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, and you know, it's a generic statement, but pretty typically I tell my customers, if you primarily want to cast, come from the end of July till about early September. And right about then is usually the transition where we're starting to do quite a bit more trolling. But just because it's September 10th, we can absolutely cast them or we can troll them. It's just starting to make that shift where, yeah, you know, early October, I'm trolling 90% of the time on Green Bay. And not to say that they can't be caught casting. It's just that's traditionally how that bite plays out.
Yeah, definitely. You know, let's talk about the northern Wisconsin thing, because up in Green Bay, obviously, if you have, you know, a handful of clients in your boat, you can run as many lines as you want to, as long as it's within, you know, the 3 per person rule.
Right.
Most of those guides are running 9 to 12 rods, I would say, depending upon how many people are in the boat. You know, if you're up in northern Wisconsin, it's you and, you know, one other person in the boat. I think you're only able to run 2. If you have 2 clients, you can run 3. You know,
yeah, 1 per person, max 3 per boat.
Right. And, you know, how do you do that? Like, if it's just 2 people, obviously, if you can run 6 lines, if there was 2 people on the boat, it'd be easy, right? You'd be able to, you know, you can, I shouldn't say easy, that's the wrong way to go about it. Nothing's easy in musky fishing, but you can run 6 different baits, so you could run, you know, a handful of different colors, you can run a handful of different depths, and you can dial it in a lot quicker. How do you dial it in with just 2 baits? This is the same, let's assume it's you and a buddy in the boat.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, there's no doubt about it. With more lines, it's absolutely easier to develop a pattern because, like you say, you can run similar baits, you can run different styles of baits, different colors, different depths. Typically, I have a pretty good idea of what's going on, and I pretty typically have an idea what's going to work. So if I've got 2 lines, I'm typically putting 2 of the baits that I know are going to get bit, and I'm going to stagger them a little bit in depth just for a little experimentation. But I've usually got a pretty good idea of what's going to work. And then it's just still a matter of fine tuning it, whether that's a color or a depth or a vibration thing. But I still, what I'm going to do when I've got 2 or 3 lines versus say 6 or 9 or 12, I'm going to put stuff out there that I know is going to pull, or at least certainly that I think is going to pull. And I'm going to put it where I think it needs to absolutely be. If I'm trolling with multiple lines, I'm going to put a couple baits that I know are going to go where I know that they need to be. But I'm also going to put some other flyer stuff out there, whether that's a really high bait, or really deep bait, or maybe a really big bait, comparatively speaking. Just something out there. And that extra flexibility is just helping me to find some of those maybe more off the wall patterns. Or, you know, there's times where I'm wrong and I expect them to want something small with a tight wobble and it's not working. And I make a big switch to a bigger bait with a really wide wobble, and all of a sudden they're eating it. And so it just allows you to be a little bit more flexible with more lines, and it allows you to establish that dinner a little faster. But there's no doubt I still am going to put my go-tos out there. So there's just a little less experimentation with less lines, I guess.
You know, one thing I'll ask you, and we've talked about this on, you know, podcasts before, do you, you know, you hear about the Ohio bite or those type of early season trolling bites, 3 feet of line behind, you know, be out behind the boat on a down rod. Do you mm-hmm. ever experience any of those types of bites up in northern Wisconsin?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of that kind of stuff, you know, muskies are muskies. Now, certainly there's different behaviors, different types of water and different nuances. You know, Green Bay, for example, pretty traditionally a small bait bite. You know, Minnesota, pretty traditionally a big bait bite. But a lot of that just comes down, I think, to anglers as well. A lot of those bites translate to a lot of different waters, but they aren't necessarily doing them because they don't have experience with that, and they don't necessarily have confidence that that's going to work. And that's one thing that the travel has helped me with. I take a lot of things that I've seen work all over the place, and I've applied them to places that people have told me that doesn't work here. It absolutely does work better. You know, I always say, I have a client of mine that always says, I want to catch one on big rubber. And the first thing he does is clip on a bucktail. And I'm like, well, let me tell you what. The best way to catch one on big rubber is going to be to throw big rubber. And I think that that idea translates a lot. Guys, I don't catch them on Green Bay speed trolling blades. Well, if you've never had your boat above 5 miles an hour trolling blades, you're not going to catch them speed trolling blades. They will eat them fast. They will eat speed troll blades on Green Bay. But if you're not doing it, you'll never see it. And so I think a lot of that, those regional bites, I think that they will translate to a lot of other water. They're just not necessarily being utilized because people don't have the confidence in it.
All right. Well, this is something I go to a lot, like patterning on, you know, that's always the key in muskies, right? Getting the pattern dialed down. But
absolutely.
As you mentioned there, you know, if you speed troll at 5 miles an hour, how long are you going to try that pattern before you're like, yeah, I'm not, that's not the pattern today. That's the one thing I think with musky anglers is we stick to like things that we've done before too long, I think, before we make changes. And I'm guilty of it myself. You know, like this is the way I've caught them before. And this is what I think they should be doing. But and because, you know, a good day in muskie fishing can be seeing a muskie, for sure a good day is catching a muskie, you know, we sometimes go like they're either just not biting or whatever, instead of making a change like we, you know, where maybe we could have triggered a bite that day had we changed up our thought process. Instead, we continue to bang our head against the wall doing the same thing for 8 hours or 10 hours or 12 hours versus making a change. And I guess to make the long question shorter, how long do you do a particular pattern before you're like, that's not the pattern today?
Well, I think there are a lot of variables to that. I know exactly what you mean. A lot of times it's just a judgment call. You know, if I'm marking fish and I know that we're putting the baits in front of fish and they're not eating them, that's a different scenario than, man, we haven't seen a fish. We haven't marked a fish. You know, there might not be fish here where I think they should be. So some of that is a little bit dependent on those variables and what I'm seeing and what I've been experiencing too. Like if I know that there's fish utilizing this weed bed and I know they're in there and I know that, and we've seen them on side imaging or we ran over them over sonar and they're not eating, that's a different scenario to me than, man, we're not seeing any fish. Maybe they slid out onto the sand. Did they drop off this break? Did they slide out off the structure? Or are they just buried up in that cabbage and they're just not interested? And I think that there has to be a little bit of flexibility and adjustment and judgment call based on what you're seeing in that scenario. I guess that being said, if I'm running a bunch of lines and I'm seeing fish and they're not eating it, I'm swapping baits fairly regular to try to find something that's going to make them eat it. And whether that's, it could be a color change. It could be a bait action change. It could be a bait size change. It could be just a totally, completely different bait. Like maybe I need to run some rubber over them, or maybe I need to run some blades through there instead of crankbaits. And so a lot of times I'll make those shifts as I go, and I kind of swap baits in and out, but I'm still keeping a lot of my staples in there. And that's where, going back to what we talked about with the multiple lines, is an advantage. There's some days where even if I don't get a single bite, there's a couple baits that just aren't coming off. They're just not. They're the number one bait that gets bit in my boat on that body of water in those conditions. Even if they haven't gotten bit, they're not coming off. I've got enough other lines that I'm going to experiment with those. So there isn't really, I don't really have a firm answer. It's kind of just a judgment call based on what I'm seeing and what I'm feeling.
All right, well, let me ask you this. This might seem like an odd question. How long, I'm assuming you'd consider yourself very proficient at side imaging. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay. How long do you suppose it took you of just playing around with side imaging before you got to be really good at side imaging?
You know, I would say that it took me a season to get pretty good with, and I wouldn't say that I'm really good. There's a lot better guys on electronics than me, but I definitely have a real good understanding of what I'm looking at and how to interpret that. And I would say that the first season that I had side imaging was that the biggest learning curve. I mean, There's so many different things that I learned as far as looking at different bottom types and how you interpret some of those readouts. Like, you know, when I first started looking at that stuff, I was using it mainly for just seeing those weed edges and seeing how that contour visually looks. And that was extremely helpful. But I would say it took a season of really learning how to run it properly, to be able to see what I'm trying to see, to be able to kind of read where those fish are in my spread and how to get a bait over them. I've never been a really heavy electronics guy. I mean, I certainly rely on electronics. I certainly value them, but I've never been that guy that goes and buys the newest locator that's out there just because it's better than the one I have. I'm more of a run a boat for 10 years, sell it and replace it with a new boat and put all new electronics that are up to date there. I'm not a boat swapper. I don't sell my boat every year. I don't like that. It takes me a year or two to get it set up just how I like it. And then I run it until I feel like it's time for it to go. And I've, you know, the electronics have come so far. And even what I'm doing on a daily basis, you know, it's just a drop in the bucket on what can actually be done with those. I love electronics and I love utilizing them to help me succeed as a guide and as a fisherman. But I do value a lot of just relying on my gut instinct and my experience and reading the water just with my own eyes and finding those current seams and wind blown points. I love electronics, but I don't like to live or die by them. I like to still feel like I have a little bit of that intuition and instinct in there as well.
Now, the reason I ask is because I always feel like there's obviously a lot of talk about live imaging, forward-facing sonar. That's a huge hot button issue right now. But I still think that there's a ton of people, myself included, that don't properly use their side imaging to its full advantage. Because I'm not trying to vilify you. I'm just questioning you. Do you use forward-facing sonar in your boat?
So I have one in the Kingfisher. I rarely use it. What I really like it for, when I'm trolling, I love to be able to see the dive depths. And that's what I use it for most. I don't use it a lot casting. I just don't. And it's one of those things where I have mixed feelings on it. I think it's one of those things where it's a learning tool and it's a cool thing. I've learned so much about fish behavior from watching them. But I also, I think that there's a lot of ethical things in there where it can be used wrong. But to me, we're just scratching the surface of what can be done with those things. And I'm not a huge electronics guy. Most of the time when I'm using it, I feel like it's taking away from me being me and interacting with my clients. I'm so focused on trying to watch all of those screens. And I'm guilty of that with side imaging as well. And so I definitely try to make it a point to minimize it. I feel like I'm taking time away from when my clients can be asking me questions, or I can be watching their casting in their retrieves and watching their figure eight. And I feel like my time is more valuable dedicating it kind of to them and their fishing rather than me trying to see a fish to chase down. That's just me personally.
Sure. Well, I guess to go full circle, tie all my questions back together is, would you say then side imaging is far more important to you than live imaging?
It is for me. Yeah, I just don't use a lot of the live imaging stuff, but I definitely use side imaging in my day-to-day stuff. So yeah, for me it is. I like it. It, like I say, for me, it fits my style of fishing a little better. I don't feel like it's as intrusive as to what I'm trying to do.
Yep.
So I definitely rely on side imaging a lot more than I do on any kind of full facings.
Fair. And I feel the same way. And I guess, like I said, to tie everything all together, the reason I was, you know, asking certain questions is because I was curious to know, you know, how long it took you to be proficient at side imaging, because basically I feel like the forward-facing sonar is getting a lot of talk, and I feel like there's a lot of people that are chasing down that road, whereas this older technology is still, it's still very, very, you know, important to be used, and I feel like a lot of anglers don't even know how to use that technology, and they just keep chasing the newest thing all the time instead of learning how to be proficient at what they're currently doing, you know, does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely think you're right there. And forward-facing sonar is one of those too, where, you know, I don't buy into the argument that, you know, anybody can go do it. There is still a learning curve there, of course. And you have to become proficient with that, just like you do with side imaging, just like before that we had to do with sonar. There's a lot of guys now that they don't hardly use their sonar, and they're definitely not using it to its capabilities. And that's because they never really relied on it, because side imaging was the buzzword. And so there's all those technologies that are out there, and becoming a good musky angler is utilizing a lot of those different technologies and knowing when to lean on one versus the other. And a lot of that goes back to kind of what we talked about before, where not everybody is going to advance at the same speed or experience level. People, I'm fortunate. I'm on the water every day. And, you know, not all year, but during musky season, I'm on the water every day. Most guys don't have that time. They're not going to get that experience just from going out 3 weekends a year. They're not going to go out there and go start live scope sniping muskies on day one. That's just not how it's going to work. It never worked that way with other electronics either. You've got to get them dialed in. And a lot of it still comes down to you need to understand muskies and their behavior. That's still all, that's just a little piece of that puzzle.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. All right. So guys, we're, you know, well past the 1 hour mark into this conversation. I'd love to continue the conversation, but in respect to your time, Brian, I think that at some point we should get you back on, and you know, we kind of got a lot of background out of it, but, you know, are you guys open to, at some point, Brian, would you be interested in coming back on talking further about musky fishing with us?
Yeah, absolutely.
Brad, did you,
yeah.
off record, did you have anything else to tie this one in? We're at an hour and 8 minutes.
No, What happened for me tonight, Brian, is I gained a ton of respect for you, and I wish I had some time where I had met you previous to this, but just the little bit of conversation that we've had in between, I think it's been huge, and yeah, I'm super excited. I think that we should do something else, and I think that you have a ton to offer to everybody, and I think it's huge. So that's my 2 cents.
Yeah.
I don't know what we can add to this episode at this point, being where we are in the timeline, but I definitely think we should circle back and make something even bigger from this.
Yeah. Brian, I mean, at some point, like I said, I'd like to get you on. It'd be great. You know, just be, there's like Brad just said, I mean, I feel like we just barely scratched the surface on, yeah, just talking to you about, you know, outdoor stuff and your thoughts on musky fishing. And it's been a fun conversation. So I really do appreciate your time.
Yeah, this was great. Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
But Brian, before we let you go, if people, you know, I'm hoping people were intrigued by everything we talked about today, all the travel, all the different stuff. The passion is obviously off the charts. You know, for people that want to get in touch with you, how do they go about doing that again?
The best way to reach me is my cell phone, 414-801-3700. You can also email me, kleinhunts@yahoo.com. You can also find me on my website, www.kleinoutdoors.net. And certainly on any of my social media accounts, Brian J. Klein on Facebook, Klein Outdoors on Instagram. Those are about the two main that I use. So you can reach me anyway. I'm always in the field or out in the woods. So if you don't get a hold of me, just leave a message and I certainly will get back to you.
Perfect. Well, thanks again, Brian. I really do appreciate all your time tonight. I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in for another episode. And we will have another one for you again next week, Wednesday.